follow along.
And the next segment of the program is in the hands of David Braddock, whom you met earlier, the director of the Coleman Institute. David.
Hi, thanks, Clayton. And I'm going to coordinate the panel that's going to provide perspectives from basically consumers. And we have with us today Ann Caldwell, who's the Chief Research and Innovations Officer of the ARC. She'll tell you more about the ARC. I hope each panelist, I hope, will take time to talk about their particular organization. One of the bridges that we'd like to see this conference develop with all of you is to, for those of you from industry and from more technical backgrounds, we'll come to get to know more deeply the nature of the cognitive and developmental disabilities arena. And you have representation of leaders of organizations in that sphere on this panel. Ann Caldwell is Chief Research and Innovations Officer of the ARC, as I mentioned. She'll go first, followed by Jennifer Simpson, Senior Director, Governmental Affairs, and Head of Technology Policy Initiatives at the American Association for People with Disabilities. That's what we in the trade call a cross-disability organization. It spans mental, physical, and sensory disability. It's the effort to build something on the order of an organization like the American Association of, shall we say, retired persons or older persons, a large, multifaceted organization that could represent and provide political power for people with disabilities that would be equal to the numbers that they constitute in American society, a very key organization. Lynn Tamer is president of the ARCLink, third on my left. The ARCLink has long had an affiliation with the ARC of the United States, and was started by that organization about 10 years ago with a view toward the idea that the computing and communications revolutions was going to necessitate affirmative action with respect to people with intellectual and developmental disabilities. And that's precisely what Lynn's activities are designed to advance. Nancy Ward, who's been with us for many of the Coleman conferences, is information coordinator of the Medicaid reference desk at the ARCLink. And for those of you who don't follow the minutia associated with how developmental and many other disabilities are supported financially in the United States with services, suffice it to say that Medicaid plays the most central role in that financing of all funding sources by far. If you can help people understand Medicaid, you can help people understand how to finance services and supports for people with developmental and cognitive disabilities, even including the early years and indeed throughout life. So helping through the internet to and a web-based presence to explain Medicaid to parents and to consumers is a bold and very, very necessary task. That's the Medicaid reference desk. So with that as just a little intro to the panel and their extensive background, there are also some parents on the panel with the individuals with the intellectual disabilities, their children, and they may choose or not so to bring that up in their discussions. We'd encourage them to do whatever they would wish and feel comfortable doing in their regard, in their remarks. And I suspect we'll hear some parent perspectives as well as some professional perspectives because they're all parents and professionals at the same time. So our first speaker would be Ann Caldwell.
Thank you. And just a real sincere thanks to you, Dr. Braddock, for inviting me here and for the work that Jim and Clayton and Enid and all the staff have done. It's a beautiful event. Try to imagine it's a Chicago winter day out there, so you're really not missing this beautiful fall Colorado Boulder day. This is really where you want to be. I will proudly assert that my biggest asset is being Jeffrey's mom. Jeffrey is 16 years old. He is a self-advocate, civil rights leader in his own words that also has Down syndrome. And he's really, I think, the reason that I've been able to put whatever skills and talents I have to the field, and hopefully some of those efforts are making a difference. That's certainly the goal I have every day. Just a brief word about the ARC of the United States. It is the associating organization that governs, influences, works with our national chapter network. I think I said earlier we're probably one of the largest, if not the largest, disability organization in the United States. We have more than 730 chapters across the United States, and we're in 48 of them right now. Ask me next week, and we're probably going to be in 50. But all rolled up, we are about $4 billion in size. Our mission is to advocate for the human rights and full participation of individuals with intellectual and developmental disabilities, and we also provide services as part of what we do. So again, it's just a thrill to be here. My perspectives this morning, my comments are going to address the perspectives of families and people with IDD, and IDD stands for intellectual and developmental disabilities. Since I came here a few months ago for the planning conference for this session, I hopped on my Southwest plane going back to DC, and I began a listening tour of my own. So I didn't brand it, I didn't use anybody's trademark, but I set out to do a mindful exploration in conversations with families, parents, siblings, caregivers, people with IDD that I just encountered in my daily work. And these mindful conversations really brought in the topic of what we're discussing today, which is the concept of cloud computing. And so I have some anecdotal comments and observations to share. Also, some of what I'll present a little bit later are some very raw data from a large national survey that we're running that's still in the field. So I have not been able to pull down the data and really look at it. So it is what it is, but I think it provides some very interesting indicators for what we're talking about today. There is no going back. The worm has turned, and I think that the writing on the wall is as clear as it can be, in that days gone by where there is plenty of federal support, plenty of state support, plenty of resources to address the needs of people with intellectual and developmental disabilities were abundant. Those days are gone. And as much as I applaud my colleagues in D.C. in the policy arena and in the government agencies, some of whom are sitting in the front row, for doing what they can to bring down more resources, it's time to move forward. It's time to advance. And that's why this is so exciting. The conversation today is just it's stimulating beyond my expectations, but it really brings me a sense of hope that I will take back to my organization and to the families they serve to say there's something going on and you need to know about it. Families are incredibly resilient. They are dedicated. They are devoted to finding solutions where there are no solutions to be found. And what's interesting about the families is that they span the lifespan of the person that is connected to them that have IDD. So we've got families that are just finding out about their child's, their brand new baby's disabilities. We've got parents of children who are just newly diagnosed with autism at earliest 18 months, 24, 36 months. Some of the kids with less resources are being identified at 5 or 6. Lost opportunity, you noted. Families are encountering the challenges of understanding what disability means within the context of their lives. And then you get older. You go to school. You have an IEP. You find out what you can and cannot get, and you fight the system to get every last drop of support. Your child continues to get older, as do you, no matter how much you protest. Eventually, they age out of the public school system or the educational system, and then they face life beyond the age 22. What does that mean for some of the people with IDD? It means they either go to post-secondary options. I see that DOE has just now released about $10 million in support of community college and university grants for these entities to create programs, college programs. And you get, as you go up the trajectory, they leave college or they go right into a work track. Unfortunately, most people with IDD do not go to work in a community business. Most people with IDD work in a sheltered workshop. It's about 74-76% out of the total workforce, and they may or may not be earning competitive wages, and most of them are not. So then you follow them up through their work life, and then they start to retire. So what I'm giving you is a span of interaction with the families, and since they provide most of the care throughout the lifetime of their family member with IDD, family members are highly influential and pivotal in the decisions that are made. So when we're looking at the families themselves, first of all, we've got a generational difference that I think is really important to this conversation. You've got kids that are underneath the age of 22, many of whom have grown up with IDEA, educational supports, IEPs, and an expectation that you will learn and that you will be using the computers in school and you will be working on transition issues. Granted, not all of these services are optimal. Some are better than others. But the general culture of education lately has been more of inclusion. People, and there's federal law that backs that up. So you've got this cadre of families in this younger generation that fully expect that when transition age comes, their kids are going to be a full member of the community because that's what they've been told by the educational system. Then, if you go on the other end of that scale, you've got older families that are used to days gone by. They might be used to more traditional and outdated attitudes towards what their family member with IDD is capable of. And so you've got really two stratification of the families. The similarities between these generations do exist. We are all experiencing a drastic cut in funding. And so that has direct implications on how we as families turn to other resources and other options that are not funded by state, local, or Fed money. We have to, because the money's drying up and there's nowhere else to turn. We're all deeply engaged with our communities and our families. So when you look at an individual with intellectual developmental disabilities, most times that person is very closely surrounded by another, that nucleus is surrounded by support in their immediate family and siblings and aunts and uncles and grandparents and community members and people that band around them. So really, when you impact the life of one person with an intellectual and developmental disability, you're really reaching a whole host of other consumers, which I think might be interesting for some of the corporations. And disability is all across the globe in every class, in every ethnicity, poor, rich, middle class. So it's a universal experience, although the experiences vary. So what have I heard from the last couple of months when I'm talking to families? First of all, there's little knowledge or awareness of the term cloud computing. I saw that Microsoft is now running a commercial. I don't know if you've seen it, but it's about, oh, I can't take a picture of my family because they're all, you know, doing something strange. Let me go to the cloud. And then you see her swing to the computer, draw down something, adjust the picture, and voila, she's got a perfect family portrait. That's the first instance I've seen of a public sort of marketing effort to engage the public and educating them about what the cloud technology is. But once I explained it to people, they got it. So, I mean, I think that was one of the things that I found out, that there's little awareness right now of what the term cloud computing means. I also found out that families are turning towards the market for solutions, and they're going to places like Apple and Microsoft and Dell and Home Depot. And they're looking at everyday solutions for very customized needs. And they're going there, and they're not asking the feds to pay for it or their state to pay for it. They're paying for it out of pocket. And I think one of the things that our survey is showing is that we do have, there's plenty of proof that families are paying for supports for their children or their family members out of pocket. But this is also a consumer-driven variable that I think is important when we're looking at providing options. The key concerns that I've heard from families in terms of this cloud computing concept is they want to know if the solutions that you're designing are going to work. It's great to say it, but if it doesn't work in the field, if it breaks down, if there's no backup plan for support, it's not going to work for them. So they really are looking for an assurance that the solutions that are designed really attend to the individual needs. And one of the things I'd like to challenge each one of the computer and technology wizards that are in the room is to immerse yourself. Don't visit. Spend a day. Sit with a family. Go through the motions of what they go through every day. Really, truly seek to understand what some of the diversity needs are. Because unless you, you know, if you have them in and you talk to them for an hour or two, it's probably not going to give you the information you need, and they're probably not going to be sure that you really understand. So I really urge you to find ways, and of course, if you need some pilot sites to go or people to meet with, we can help. How am I doing?
Okay.
On time?
Maybe 1 minute.
1 minute. Opportunities. The opportunities are that they really wish to have more independence but not lose the interdependence, because I think, it, as Nancy might speak to, self-advocates really deeply need and want a level of interdependence, and it's not a negative thing. We all need each other, and I think it's one of the strengths of the self-advocacy movement. The viable solutions that you create are likely to also create significant budget relief for families. And a lot of them are experiencing economic stress. The trending is, I think, in the future, is to relying on market solutions. And by far, one of the most important things is, as these wonderful technologies are developed, having a strategic education plan that fully explains, layers the knowledge in the family and the intended market is something that we really need to pay attention to. So that's my comments.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Next up is Jennifer Simpson, AAPD.
Yeah, I'm with AAPD. I'm Jennifer Simpson. Thank you for the great intro you gave for me, and talking about the American Association of People with Disabilities. It's a relatively new organization in the disability space, being around since 1995 after the ADA passed. There was a sense that there needed to be a membership organization of people with disabilities, somewhat like the model of AARP, and so that's how we were formed. Our mission is to organize the disability community, and that means working collaboratively with other organizations. I specifically work with National Association of the Deaf, American Council of the Blind, Telecommunications for the Deaf, American Foundation for the Blind, and other key advocacy organizations that focus on sensory disability, because my area of expertise is technology and telecommunications. And it's the interfaces we've been talking about today that actually focus on what our needs are in technology. I'm also the co-chair and founder of the Coalition of Organizations for Accessible Technology, known as COAT. We were the group in Washington, the Coalition of Organizations, and we're now over 310 organizations nationally, that was formed to get the new legislation, the 21st Century Communications and Video Accessibility Act, that you've been hearing a little bit about today. And I'd be happy to give anybody any further details on that later if they want it. But that's not the focus of what I'm talking about now. When I'm not being busy with those things, I do my real life job, which is basically I'm a caregiver for a young man. My son is 25 with cerebral palsy. He works in a shelter workshop. We fit the profile that she gave. My family fits the profile. He's severely disabled, mentally and physically, very healthy, very happy. I don't think if we talked to him about cloud computing, he'd have a clue, but then I didn't really have much of a clue either. And most of the people I talked to on my way here to Colorado, when they asked me where I was going, I told them, they said, well, it's cloud computing. So I think it's about relevancy, what we're really talking about. I'm also the caregiver for an 83-year-old mother who used to be a teacher in the private school system, but she herself now is showing quite a few intellectual disabilities, not that she would ever admit to a single one of them. And I think we're all very familiar with that. But so when I started thinking about cloud computing, I said to myself, you know, as this caregiver person who also does policy work, what are the things that I could find in the cloud that might help me? So I started to think about some of the processes. And I think, actually, this is not really about accessibility and usability, although I suppose you could say these need to be accessible and usable. I really need to, I've got stacks of paper for these two individuals. So this is all about case management and all the services and the qualifications to be eligible for certain things for my elderly mother and my son with adult son with disabilities. And if there was a way for all of that stuff to somehow be managed so that when we do have the individualized rehabilitation plan meeting, which is what my older son needs, all the people that are associated with that, if they could somehow share those records in some way, but then also they need the limitations because there's certain things in those records I don't want certain people to see. So these issues of being able to segregate off information have become very important to me. And his medical records, too, what's in those. So certain people need to see certain things. So I, as the caregiver, need to sort of, I would really like to have a way to manage all of that electronically if I could, rather than these stacks of folders that I carry around. And that's true for my mother, too. Her set of needs, and I think it was you earlier, Anne, talked about how the needs of people who are elderly with intellectual disabilities are quite different from other intellectual disabilities, and never is this more true than when it comes to services. The services for aging people are quite different for people, young men with severe physical and mental disabilities. So when she tries to make a phone call to set up her, she's in a retirement plan, health plan, she cannot get through the IVR, the voice menu at all. So I'm the one ending up doing that. So I need access to all her personal information, her social security number, all that kind of stuff. So if there were ways to somehow manage this electronically in the cloud, this would really save me tons of time. So I'm hoping that we can get that. So I'm very hopeful that way, with all those caveats that I mentioned about security and privacy. Another area where AAPD has been looking at is in the health information technology area. We did a small study, and we're going to be publishing it later when we got a little bit more out of it. We studied electronic health records, EHRs, personal health records, and the perceptive attitude that people with disabilities might have to this. We weren't really sure what we'd find, but we did find that, just like myself, control of the record is really important, like who gets to see it, who gets to see what kinds of information in it. Everybody felt really that they would like to have a health electronic health information record that they could share with their relevant people, doctors, dentists, insurance companies, or when they move. You know, everybody saw the advantages of this. But again, always it's like, who's going to get to snoop? Because in our community, snooping leads to discrimination. We have to be very careful about who gets to see stuff about us. And we had quite a few stories come out through this study from people around that issue. Another issue which surprised me greatly when we got the replies back, was around they didn't want their information shared with government entities. They were very nervous about Social Security getting Medicaid information about them or personal health information being shared with wrong government entities. So that was something that kind of surprised us when it came out. Again, the topic of accessibility to health information technology by both consumers and employees of healthcare institutions came up. There was a sense, particularly around vision disability, that we would see repeats of the same stuff that has happened with ATMs and with other kiosk technologies, where you know everybody forgot that people with vision disability actually use these things, and so the same mistakes would be made again. So we need to learn, I think, from our technology past, not to duplicate as we go forward with the devices that are going to attach to the cloud and do whatever it is that we want. Another example that came to mind where the cloud could help my son Joshua is he's a user of an alternative augmentation communication device. It's basically a box that's loaded with some language and there's glyphs on it that which he presses the images for, I need to go to the bathroom, or it's time for me to quit work, or it's got a bunch of sentences basically loaded on it. It needed a repair, and it went back to the company that we bought it from, and inadvertently they wiped out the whole memory. So it occurred to me that wouldn't it be nice to have had this device with all that vocabulary that we worked so hard to get right to match the glyphic images, if that had been stored, number one, had a backup, number two, that it was just out there somewhere in the cloud, so that no matter where he was, and if he had this particular box, which he knows how to use because it's been set up exactly for him with the size images and the colors and the key dividers, so his hand, which is very clumsy, can use it, and which he uses for communication. Wouldn't it be nice if we could have just sort of said, you know, tap it into the cloud and get all that vocabulary back again. As it is, he's been without this box, and he's not speaking to this group of people that he normally speaks to at work. If he's in a shelter workshop, again, we're fitting the profile. So, you know, he's without a voice. So when we talk about civil rights and technology, we're talking about, you know, devices that actually permit civil rights. So he gets to speak because he has a speech box. You and I speak because we have voices, but this is critical to him. So we need to think very much more, I think, more deeply about technology devices and how that allows civil rights to manifest. Myself, in terms of the electronic technology, I use, and how much more time do I have? Okay. I use a lot of social media. Social media, you know, I have two blogs. You know, maybe I'm two blogs. I have two Facebook accounts, two Twitters, for different reasons. So that whole issue of identity and who you are and authentication started to be, that discussion earlier was enormously interesting to me because I use the social media for different purposes. Some of it's very personal and some of it is for organizing purposes in the community or for other purposes. So I think we need to really explore that more in terms of our own needs for what we need to have done. So which identity it is that I'm using. I think it was you talked about role. Somebody here talked about the role that you use. And so the thing is, as a caregiver, I have multiple roles. So sometimes I'm, you know, the mom of Joshua. Sometimes I'm the daughter of Suzette. And sometimes I'm just Jennifer trying to get her healthcare records straightened out. So there are many different identities, some of which are, quote, more legal than others, and some of which are just fun. Like I have a blog where I'm somebody else completely, and I talk about the plants in my garden, for instance. So
do I.
Oh, well, there we go.
Oh,
see?
My gosh.
Something about moms of disabled young men? I don't know. Maybe we need our gardens. I don't know. Something.
There we go.
But anyway, I just want to make the point that these questions may seem somewhat, you know, what's the word I'm trying to say? I don't know. I'm having a cognitive moment, I guess. But the point is, you know, we need to really think through, for us as people with disabilities, as caregivers, as families, what all these implications are when we move more and more stuff into the cloud that we are actually going to be using. I also want to emphasize, you know, most of my life is taken up with public policy work, and I just want to talk about how important it is to have people with disabilities involved every step of the way in that process. When we were negotiating the language on the 21st Century Bill with the industry stakeholders, I mean, it was extremely important that people with vision disability, that people with hearing disabilities were present, and other physical disabilities were there, because sometimes that was made the difference in understanding. So I want to echo what Anne said about the involvement of companies in the private sector and developers and app people in getting to know us better so that there's a greater understanding of the needs and of the barriers and the kind of issues that we face on a daily basis. I almost can't emphasize that too much. And the suggestion earlier that more people attend the Self-Advocates Becoming Aware conference, I thought was marvelous. And just to sort of tell you a little bit how I think people that, I just want to generalize a little bit about people with intellectual disability. My son lives in an intensive care facility for people with mental retardation. It's a very old-fashioned environment. He lives with about 20 other young men, all with very severe physical and intellectual disabilities. And they have no friends outside of in the community. They have very few visitors, very few people pay attention to their needs who are not the staff at this particular institution. And so I think loneliness and lack of social connection is actually a real big topic in our community that we don't often really talk about. But I think if the direction we're going in is more and more the cloud and stuff we could pull in and the ability to have maybe virtual environments that people could become part of and belong to, if people show these young men how to do that, I think that would be something that we could also think about the direction that could occur. I didn't have anything else. I'm sure I've reached my time, but I did want to make one point that I actually think that the cloud could really do really well, and that's real-time captioning. And I think this was talked about a little bit earlier, you know, the whole idea that there's servers over here and translation here and whatever, software there, I don't know. You know, it is the holy grail for it to have real-time captioning occur as I'm speaking, to have the text there, which, by the way, doesn't just help people with hearing disabilities, it helps the rest of us too. You know, as I'm aging, I'm losing my ability to hear completely, but also I know people with other disabilities really benefit from captioning, and I think that's true for a lot of the things that we sort of say, oh, that's for people who are blind. Video description is for people who are blind, captioning is for people who are deaf. Actually, no, those things actually help all of us a great deal, and even if we don't want to admit it, like my mom, who won't turn the captioning on television. But the fact of the matter is, you know, we're now growing up, our world is changing, it's going to happen, we might as well take advantage of it. The cloud could do it, and I'm extremely hopeful about all of it.
Thank you very much. Okay, now we'll skip over to Nancy Ward on the far end.
Okay. As a person with an intellectual disability, I feel that my disability has played a big part in my life, like being in special ed and not getting the accommodations that I needed. When I tried to get a college degree, people didn't know how to support someone with an intellectual disability. So I wasn't able to learn what I was capable of learning. People didn't believe I could do what I thought I could do. One of the things that is very frustrating to me is when we get put in this box and we're not allowed to go outside that box. I think that that's one of the things that the cloud computing would allow us to do, is to be able to get outside of that box. For example, I only got a certificate of completion from high school, even though I thought I was earning a diploma. I eventually earned 30 credit hours at a community college before I realized I couldn't earn a degree, because I couldn't do some of the classes without accommodations. I worked in a bunch of different nursing homes, and then I got a job in a workshop. Eventually, I was offered the job of being a supervisor, but lacked the confidence to take it, even though I was doing the job, working in a workshop, does not give people confidence in themselves. In fact, people do not believe in you. I I did end up training my new supervisor, though. At that point, I got angry and went and got my own job. At this point, I am the information and training coordinator for the Medicaid Reference Desk, a website, and we believe the first website that has made Medicaid accessible, if you can make Medicaid accessible. And I'm also the co-director of the National Technical Assistance Center on Voting and Cognitive Access. Both jobs and my many roles in the self-advocacy movement have required me to become a heavy user of computers and the internet. I also spend a lot of time helping other people with disabilities use these technologies. And one of the things that I wanted to share with you was when we had the National Self-Advocacy Conference last month, we had people who did a survey on iPads. And it was a survey on self-determination. So it was something people wanted to do. It talked about their lives. And we had 54 people from Oklahoma go to the national conference. And out of those 54 people, 20 of them bought iPads when they got home because they were able to access the computer in a way that was meaningful to them. From what I understand, the cloud could be a big help to people with intellectual disabilities, but there are some barriers to overcome. And I wanted to go back a second because I skipped a part. I've been struggling to understand the cloud because until people asked me to be a part of this panel, I didn't know anything about the cloud. Even though I was doing it, I didn't know what it was. And so I hope my comments will reflect my thoughts and concerns. Many people are just afraid of computers or don't have confidence about using them. Computers can make them feel stupid. There might be many useful programs in the cloud, but they need to be affordable and findable. There needs to be accessible training opportunities at all levels and for people using all kinds of assistive technology. There needs to be accessible information about what is available in the cloud and how it might be useful. For example, when I first started working on the Medicaid Reference Desk, the people who were on the team at the time believed that like people before me have said that people with disabilities need to be included in whatever part of their life you're working on. And I've been included since the very beginning of the desk. And when I first started working on the computer, I thought that we were going to have to take this big stack of paper and figure out how we were going to fit it in this machine. And I didn't know how we were going to do that. But now I understand how to use the computer and how to access it.
This is the professor.
Okay. Some of these barriers might be overcome or partly overcome if there were profiles about users stored in the cloud that would match people to the programs they need automatically. For example, like my example earlier of having people with intellectual disabilities, the accommodations that a lot of us need is to have things explained to us. Well, if you explain something to somebody, then you're influencing their understanding of what it is that you're explaining to them. Okay. There needs to be accessible help for all programs. And I don't know how possible this would be technically, but it would be very cool if the cloud became a possible. I think many people would worry about privacy, though. If this information were just out there, also many people are constantly told not to share information, not to share personal information on the internet. So they would be reluctant to do so. I think the most important thing is that people with disabilities, including people with intellectual disabilities, be included all through the planning and implementation of cloud computing or anything else that you're doing. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Lynn?
Well, I keep writing down more notes of things I want to say. I guess that's the problem of being last. I want to say a little bit about the ARCLink and our history, because it started, I think my predecessor, Albert Johns's original vision was primarily to provide enough information to families to help their family members with disabilities exercise genuine choice, because it was the beginning of the self-determination movement, and self-determination doesn't mean anything if you don't know what's possible. And I think over time, he became more and more involved with self-determination in terms of self-advocates. And so although our initial website, and if you visit it, which is thearclink.org, you'll see it's not an accessible website. And it's on our list to fix that, okay, on our very long list of tasks. But if you go to our more recent websites like The Desk or govoter.org, both of which Nancy's affiliated with, you'll see that they've changed radically, and I think at this point are pretty good examples of at least a good first try at cognitive access. And we also, another thing that we're working on now is well, we call it the accessible on-ramp to the information highway. And it's a web-based tutorial for just the very basics of email and web browsing for people with intellectual disabilities. So it goes very step-by-step, lots of pictures, and then lots of backup. So additional information to fill in gaps. And we expect the more it's used, the more that will grow. And in connection with that, I was just in Alabama. I just came in last night from Alabama at their People First statewide convention where I was running an internet cafe. And our primary goal was obviously to tell people about our program and then also about these websites. But it gave me a little chance just to talk to people about their experience with using computers and how they felt about it. The first thing was that an awful lot of people thought that that room wasn't for them. So they didn't even come in. Like, they had so much absorbed the idea that they couldn't do the internet. And the People First director worked very hard to encourage everybody to come in. So our traffic became better. And most of the people who came in didn't know that maybe they could learn to do this. Those people who already used computers fell into two groups. People who use computers to play games, often in their day programs, and people who had jobs that required some kind of computer use. None of them were using computers to meet their personal needs. Okay, so, well, and then there was one person, okay, who was using email a little bit to communicate. But for the most part, they didn't have any idea of the kind of information that might be out there that they even could access. And one of the issues, like with the that we talked about a little bit, or other people did, of the accessibility features that are already in the operating systems, both the Apple platform and the Windows platform, virtually no one knows they're there. They don't know how to use them, and there's some interesting features of them. One, for example, to get the voice recognition to work, you have to teach the computer to understand you. Well, you do that by reading fixed texts. So if you can't read those fixed texts, you can't train the computer to understand you. So we've been thinking a lot about how to get around that. But I think really we need a different approach to training the computer. Also, a lot of people do have speech issues. So I'm not sure, you know, where the technology is right now to deal with that particular issue. But I think in terms of the ArcLink, we've really moved sort of, at least in my view since I came over, of taking Albert Johns' idea that self-advocacy requires information, and to now information these days requires the internet. More and more of the information that's out there is only on the internet. Or, you know, there are like 300-page documents from the government that it's very hard to find the one sentence that applies to you. But if you get an Adobe document and you know how to do this, you can then search for those three words and find it. But that takes an awful lot of skill and an awful lot of practice. And so that, yes, it requires the internet, but then it also requires access to the internet in all sorts of ways. From the fact most people can't afford an internet connection even if somebody gives them an old computer. So, you know, we have issues all the way through there. And one thing I think that a lot of people don't realize is that a lot of adults with intellectual disabilities have family members or caregivers who are actively resisting them being able to use the internet. I think there's sort of that. From my point of view, there's understandable fears and fears that drive me up a wall. The understandable fear is safety. And there's certainly lots of stories out there about people running up massive bills on shopping sites or falling for phishing scams and all kinds of stuff like that. So people are very worried. They're worried about physical safety, financial safety, all kinds of safety. The other fear, and this comes more from institutions, group homes, is fear that the people will become empowered. Okay, and so internet access becomes a really radical idea.
Yep.
And yeah, Nancy's very involved with the whole deinstitutionalization movement, so she can certainly speak to that. But there are many group homes that don't allow people to use the computers, probably for that reason. So and access can be blocked by those people, or they can be prevented from using the computer lab in the public library if someone in authority says they can't use it. The importance of public libraries I don't want to miss either. They're the primary source of access for many, many people with disabilities, as well as many other people who can't afford computers and internet access. And the positive there is that, in my experience, librarians are the most open of anybody to getting people in and being able to serve them better. So I really do feel a lot of training and sort of marketing of what's available, a target should be libraries. I mean, they are kind of the information station. There's a big problem, of course, with people who can't get to libraries, so I don't want to say they're the solution, but they're amazing. I think one thing that's really different, say for me and probably for most of the people in this room, is that I tend to have a belief that whatever I want to know is on the internet, you know, how to fix our dishwasher or whatever it is, that it's there, all I need to do is find it. That belief doesn't exist. That people don't have the experience to believe that what they need is out there. And so they're easily discouraged if they even try. And I would say, and I think some of my experience is a little different than Anne's with some of this, and I think it's because in my previous job, I was an advocacy coordinator for an organization that served families on who were themselves eligible for Medicaid. So very low-income families. And everything we say about disability pretty much applied to the whole family. Okay, so that the lack of any kind of confidence or exposure to computers was huge, even from very young parents. So it's not entirely generational. There's a huge economic issue here. Am I out of time?
1 minute.
1 minute, okay. I guess my last point, and people have touched on it, is our biggest focus is on accessible content. And when we talk about content, we talk about both sort of the language and the navigation. You know, can you get to what you need? Can you look at a complicated web page and figure out where the link you want is? And, I mean, even like when I was writing the curriculum, if you notice on most web pages, the login link is in light print, small, in a corner. So if you don't know to look for it there, you will not see it. It will not catch your eye. And so we've sort of made login big on our sites, if there's a login at all, but we try to avoid that. So it's sort of content in all of its forms, content in terms of what the words are, how it's arranged on a page, how you get from page to page, all of that stuff. And to me, I mean, I'm intrigued by that readability.com, you know, that strips web pages of the advertising. That helps a lot. But how do we get past that? And people talked about that this morning in terms of finding ways to provide, sort of present web pages in alternate formats for people who prefer one over another. And I don't think, again, that's a disability issue. The very last thing I want to say is that I've started using a term other than intellectual disability in this kind of work. The term I like is information processing difficulty. I think it's an umbrella term that includes the seniors. It includes people who don't speak English well, people with learning disabilities, people with traditional intellectual disability. And there are times when you want to break those groups apart, but in all of the work I think most of us are doing, we don't want to break them apart. And I find it's a really useful way. You get rid of the term disability, so that makes your mom happy, because she's probably willing to say she has difficulty. No? Well, my mom will say she has difficulty. She's gotten that far.
Yeah, but you do it.
Okay, well, that's that. You do it. And then information processing, that's what most of us are comfortable with, that term. And I think everyone has a little more idea what we're talking about than intellectual disability, which I think has the danger of becoming just another word like the R word. So.
Okay. Thank you. Okay, we have a few minutes for questions. Don't be bashful. Tom.
Gathering of real people with disability, librarians who do, as Liz indicated, great number, and doctors who have exactly the same problem with medical records in three hospitals. In my acquaintance in the last 4 weeks, the University of Pennsylvania, the University of California in San Diego, and Scripps, they don't know what they're doing. They're scared of it. It's not simple enough. I'll tell some part of the front page story in the New York Times. I hope you all saw it about doctors and medical records. And the only moment of hope was the first time I saw cloud computing appear as a phrase in the New York Times. We missed it otherwise. Pointing out that the iPad, with, was it 4 or 6 alternative ways to do the record, are the only things that made the doctors smart.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. In other words, what works for people with disability
works
for doctors,
everybody.
And
yeah.
There's your market.
Yeah.
I'd like to just comment on that. You know, one of the things that Bill presented on, he's not here, but Bill presented on this morning, was that graph, you know, that kind of cast us out 40 years. Think of everybody in this room and think of where we're going to be in 40 years. And if you think I'm giving up my iPhone when I'm, what, 60? you know, that's not going to happen. But, I mean, I think that's a compelling factor. I mean, one of the things we really need to do is engage the Microsofts and the Intels and the Yahoos and the Googles and everybody to realize that this is not just a tiny little population over here in the corner. What, Dr. Braddock, were there, 4.7 million people right now? Your data?
Well,
with IDD?
Intellectual and closely related developmental disabilities, but the point to be made, I think, is that anything that you've heard about that would suggest information about the prevalence of disability in our society. Remember that the vast bulk of people with disabilities, including people with intellectual and closely related developmental disabilities, are in the higher ranges of functioning. It's only at the smallest end that's at the lowest range of functioning. So the people that have some capacity, of the people who have some capacity to use the internet, to use computers in a guided way, perhaps. It's a large cohort. It's not a small cohort. There is a market, and I know it's going to take a market to make it drive in this country, unless it's done under some kind of public aid auspices. Perhaps to some degree it should be. But the vast market for people with disabilities is people who have moderate and mild disabilities, and those individuals can use, to some success, a computer.
And just as an example, Wikitiakos, my son, who does not read, took my iPhone, found YouTube, downloaded The Lion King in Chinese. Hmm. Oh. I don't know how he did that, but and I think the lady that has the child, you know, it's teachable technology that once they get it, and then it becomes a ramp for expressive communication, for understanding, for engagement, and that is what, that excitement is just, if you see it, you will never be the same person again.
One more question?
We've been doing some
two more
iPads, or at least designed at this point of iPads and applications against them, primarily focused at the staffs of assisted living and nursing environments. And our sense of it is that what's most important is you're thinking about micro-tasks. Well, the reason that apps are powerful is you're only thinking about small tasks that they have to do, that they want to do. It's about empowering them individually. And it, actually, in our case, we look at these activities, people in these institutions, and figure out what they're trying to do, and give them tools that empower the process. In this case, communicating with family and social networking and things like that. But the trick is, and I think it just works for everybody. To be honest, I actually think what they're saying is it's small pieces. These are not, some of the cloud stuff is background stuff, you know, databases and MOSIs and whatever else it is. And to be honest, you guys don't want to know about that. In fact, I have a conjecture that in 100 years, only 4 people in the world will know how data is stored in the cloud. Nobody else will care. The rest of us just do stuff. We don't care. We're going to be doing applications, and that's really the key thing here. But they're tiny, tiny things. And that makes them actually surprisingly easy to program. The question is sociology. What do people really want? My rule of thumb, by the way, is 3 to 5 words. If a person can't understand what they're going to do with that thing with 3 to 5 words, including the prepositions in that 3 to 5 words, it's too much. It's the wrong thing. It's not edit the document, edit some big thing. It's like take a picture. Or be more specific than that if you know what the work is. I think your doctors have the same situation.
Yep.
They're actually very like these people in these facilities. They're not stupid. They're sort of technologically non-engaged. But their big problem is they're just rushed. They don't have time. They've got to get to the next thing. Anything that interferes with getting to the next thing is a block to them. That's why it's driven there. But I think it applies in most cases. So I think tasks is the things you really need to tell people. Okay. Programmers, developers, tell us what people want to do.
There's one more question. In the back? Yes. All right, over here.
Just actually more of a statement. I think what's important for individuals who are using devices like that is durability, portability, and the fact that an example would be if you look at some of the communication devices, they're pretty darn expensive. They're $4,000, $5,000, $10,000. The iPad can do an awful lot of the same things for a fraction of the price. Challenge will be its durability right now because it's still working on that piece. But it gives it a larger format for those individuals who need it. But then you go to the iTouch or you go to the iPhone and you have the same application. And it's phenomenal because they can take it with them wherever they go and really open the door. It is more empowering for some individuals than trying to find someone who can sign to them so they can understand what's going on.
Yeah.
So they can take that device and they can talk to anybody. And with some devices, they can talk to anybody in any language. So it really opens up the door for them. So those are the important pieces to really keep looking at development, to be able to tie all into one spot.
Well, that's a great point, I think, to end the panel on, and to thank all the panelists and turn it back over to our esteemed chairman here.